Shalom Harabar students. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Modern Israel. We are in session 23, dealing with Israel present. All right, let's review where we were last session. Last session, we in 2004, Israeli security a security corps assassinated Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas. He was then replaced by Abdul Aziz Rantisi, and Israel's security people assassinated Abdul Aziz Rantisi, who was then replaced by Mahmoud al-Zahar. And at that point, Hamas stopped announcing who their leader was because they were afraid Israel would assassinate him. Tanzim leader Marwan Barghouti was also arrested. I commented on an article written in June 14, 2004, called Rude Shocks from Cultured Folks. June 18, 2004, the Second Intifada was over, and Israel basically has won. On November 11, 2004, Yasser Arafat died, and he was buried in Ramallah. This is his tomb in Ramallah. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, was selected as his successor. In August, the forcible evacuation of Jewish people from Gaza began with Ariel Sharon's disengagement policies. And here's a picture of the forced evacuation from the town of Kfar Darom. Then I commented on an article I'd written for Hadavar Messianic Ministries called The Gaza Handover. I made a number of points in that article. First of all, that we have never possessed all the promised land, and we do not do so today. This is the boundaries of the land during the Messianic Kingdom. Does not include Sinai, does not include the Arabian Peninsula, and the boundaries of the modern state of Israel are in the black line to the south. So there's a lot of the promised land that we have never occupied, so not occupying Gaza is not a big loss either. We will occupy all those lands eventually, especially during the Messianic Kingdom. The principle that we are operating under is blessings for obedience and curses for disobedience. The blessing of expansion for obedience. Here is King Saul's kingdom, and then with the man after God's own heart, David, in place, the kingdom expanded to this area. And then the beginning of his reign, Solomon followed the Lord. And so Israel's control of the land extended all the way to the Euphrates. And again, as Solomon turned away from the Lord, then the land began to contract. God began to contract the boundaries of the land. Now this is the Sinai area. Excuse me, this is the Gaza area. Even under King Solomon's control, we did not control all of the Philistine plain, as you can see here. And it's my expectation that we probably will not control all the Philistine plain until the kingdom itself. I also pointed out that the scripture teaches that there will be two worldwide, and the key word there is worldwide, two worldwide regatherings of the Jewish people. Number one will be in unbelief for the purpose of judgment to be experienced during the tribulation. The second one will be in faith. The purpose will be blessings, the blessings of the kingdom. And so in this class, what we're studying today, what we're seeing today, what we're witnessing today is the first regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. The tribulation is hanging over our heads. And now, in regard to the Philistine plain, specifically, Isaiah 11:14 mentions that in the context of the kingdom, of the setting up of the kingdom, that's Israel and Judah, will swoop down upon the slopes of the Philistines to the west. Now, we don't need to swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines if Jewish people are already living there and already occupying that area. So the point is that in the kingdom, we will retake the Philistine plain from Gentiles and reoccupy it, or reoccupy it personally. And then in Obadiah 19, the same statement is made, then those in the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, that's to the east, and possess, understanding in the sentence, and possess those of the Shvelah, and those of the Shvelah will possess the Philistine plain. And so again, those living in the Shvelah, that's the rolling hills in between the Judean hills and the Philistine plain, those Jewish people living there will move into the Philistine plain and possess it. So we will possess the Philistine plain eventually. Any Gentiles living in the Philistine plain is only temporary, because in the kingdom we will permanently possess the Philistine plain. So the Jewish evacuation, the disengagement plan of Ariel Sharon did not bother me at all, because it just seems to me to be consistent with what Scripture is teaching. All right, on November 21st, 2005, Ariel Sharon resigns from the Likud and begins his new political party, the Kadima. On January 4th, 2006, Prime Minister Sharon suffers a severe stroke and falls into a coma. Ehud Olmert is then made the acting prime minister. In a Palestinian election, Ismail Haniya is elected the Palestinian prime minister. Then the Israelis hold their official election, and Ehud Olmert is then elected as the official prime minister of the country. Gilad Shalit, a young soldier, is kidnapped down along the Gaza Strip. Up north, Ehud Goldwasser, a soldier, and Eldad Regev, another soldier, are kidnapped along the northern border. And this sparks the Second Lebanon War. In August 25, 2006, the world learns that Iran is developing nuclear weapons capability, and so Israel begins to prepare for that eventuality. So that brings us to the new material here. We pick it up in 2007, starting in January 17, 2007. Chief of Staff Dan Chalutz and Defense Minister Amir Peretz resign following criticism of their role in the Lebanon War. And this is Chief of Staff Dan Chalutz. And then, Defense Minister Amir Peretz. These two men resigned over the Second Lebanon War. January 30th, 2007, Fatah and Hamas reach a ceasefire agreement mediated by Egypt. This came after a series of clashes between the two forces, the forces of Fatah and the forces of Hamas, that led to the death of 32 Palestinians. So both sides welcomed the Saudi initiative to meet in Mecca, and so Hamas and Fatah agree to share power over the Palestinian Authority based on a vaguely worded agreement. But Hamas officials reiterate that they will never recognize Israel. Total consistency there. They will never recognize Israel. The U.S. and Israel insist that the new government must recognize the right of Israel to exist, disarm terrorist groups, and agree to end the violence. The quartet welcomes the role of Saudi Arabia in reaching an agreement to form a Palestinian unity government, but later affirms that this government must obey international demands to recognize Israel, to renounce violence, and to abide by previous peace agreements. Well, then Ismail Haniyeh and his cabinet resign from the unity government. Haniyeh is then reappointed by Abbas, and he begins the process of forming a new Palestinian unity government. And on March 15, 2007, that Palestinian unity government was formed. June 13, 2007, the Knesset elects Shimon Peres to serve as the 9th president of Israel. And, of course, we are familiar with Shimon Peres. Here's Shimon Peres. And he does this. He's elected as the 9th president after Moshe Katsav, resigns amid impending charges of sexual harassment of female subordinates. June 15, 2007. Hamas forces attack Fatah in Gaza and drive them out of the Gaza Strip in brutal attacks. In response, Mahmoud Abbas dissolves the unity government, but Prime Minister Haniyeh insists that the government is still in power. Only we're the ones controlling it. See, this is nothing but an attempted military coup by Hamas against Fatah. All it did was chase Fatah out of the Gaza Strip, which left Hamas in charge of the Gaza Strip. A summit at Sharm el-Sheikh, attended by Egypt, Jordan, and various Palestinians, pledges support to the Abbas government, but Egypt calls for reunification with Hamas. President Abbas then forms a new Palestinian emergency cabinet to replace the unity government, which he dissolved after Hamas took control of the Gaza Strip. Abbas selects Salam Fayyad, this is Salam Fayyad, as the new Palestinian prime minister. So now we have two Palestinian governments, Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. June 18, 2007, former Prime Minister Ehud Barak is sworn in as Israel's defense minister. And, of course, we're familiar with Ehud Barak. Barak received the vote of approval from Parliament to replace Amir Peretz, who lost to Barak in the last week's Labour Party leadership election. Then the U.S. lifted an embargo on the Palestinian government in an effort to boost the strength of President Abbas and his Fatah's party in their struggle against Hamas. July 15, 2007. Israelite priests hold the first gathering since the Temple era. Jews belonging to the tribe of Levi, particularly the Cohen clan, came together for a mass gathering in Jerusalem. It was the first large-scale gathering of the biblically mandated Israelite priests since the time of the Second Temple. The gathering included lectures and seminars on the history and future of the Temple, and culminated with all the participants declaring the priestly blessing over Israel from the Western Wall. Now, genetic research over the past several years has succeeded in isolating a particular DNA signature shared by all members of the tribe of Levi. This makes the reinstitution of Israel's priestly caste a relatively simple endeavor once the temple is rebuilt. So there's a lot of interest in rebuilding the temple. It's usually called the Third Temple, Herod's temple being the Second Temple, and of course Solomon's temple being the First Temple. But there are other groups very interested in the rebuilding of the temple as well. One of those groups is the Temple Institute in Jerusalem. When you visit the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, you will see display cases holding various items. And those items in the display cases are not museum items. They are the actual items that the Temple Institute expects, or desires at least, to be functioning in the Third Temple. For example, here you see the high priest garments. Now, the man who is designated as the high priest will wear those garments when he officiates as the high priest in the temple. And on the right, you see the incense altar in that display case. And again, that's not a museum piece. The Temple Institute expects that altar to be placed in the holy place and the incense offering to be made upon it. Now, here is a harp to be played by a Levitical musician, as part of the Levitical choir in the Third Temple. And here is a small mizrach. The mizrach collected the blood from the sacrifice and was used to take the blood to the altar and dash it against the sides of the altar. So that mizrach will be used in the sacrificial service of the Third Temple. And here's the golden table of showbread, according to the rabbinic understanding of what it should look like. And again, this table, they expect to place this table in the holy place of the Third Temple. Now, if you're more interested, if you have more interest in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, I would recommend this book by Chaim Richman, available on Amazon.com, entitled The Holy Temple in Jerusalem. And I would also recommend another book, very good one, Karta's Illustrated Encyclopedia of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, again available on Amazon.com. I would recommend both these books very highly regarding this topic. All right, July 16, 2007, President Bush calls for a Middle East peace conference. He called for this conference to be held in the fall, led by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and to include Palestinians, Israelis, and regional neighbors who support creation of a Palestinian state. And then it would include new aid measures to support the West Bank-based government of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Salam Fayyad. On July 20, 2007, Israel released 256 prisoners, granted clemency to 178 members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and scaled back its troop operations aimed at other militants in the West Bank. So Israel, time and time and time again, is trying to set a positive atmosphere for some kind of peace negotiations and resolution to the issues. July 25, 2007. The Arab League sends its first formal delegation to Israel to officially present the Arab League peace offer that would see full recognition of Israel in exchange for withdrawal from the West Bank, withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and the creation of a Palestinian state. This deal was first offered back in 2002. On July 27, 2007, Palestinian Prime Minister Fayyad presents his government's program. It seeks to establish a Palestinian state on all the lands occupied by Israel in 1967, with Jerusalem as its capital, and it also included comments about a just solution for Palestinian refugees. So things were looking very, very hopeful back in 2007 for some kind of a peace agreement. All right, let's move now from July to September 2007 in Operation Orchard. Operation Orchard was an Israeli airstrike on a nuclear reactor in the Deir ez-Zor region of Syria, carried out just after midnight on September 6, 2007. The White House and the Central Intelligence Agency later confirmed that American intelligence had also indicated that the site was a nuclear facility with a military purpose. Syria denies this. According to news reports, the raid was carried out by the Israeli Air Force 69th Squadron using F-15Is, F-16Is, and electronic aircraft. As many as 8 aircraft participated, and at least 4 of these crossed into Syrian airspace. The fighters were equipped with AGM-65 Maverick missiles, 500-pound bombs, and external fuel tanks for extended range. One report stated that a team of elite Israeli Shaldag Special Forces commandos arrived at the site the day before so they could highlight the target with laser designators. A later report identified Sayeret Matkal Special Forces commandos as being involved. But whoever was involved and exactly how they did it, it was successful. Now, this slide is a summation, an overview of Operation Orchard. On the right, we see the route that the aircraft took to get to the nuclear reactor site. And then in the middle of the picture, here is the target, the suspected target right here. So let's look at a close-up of the route that the aircraft took for Operation Orchard. We begin in step one. Step one is in Israel. Around 11 p.m., 10 Israeli F-15I fighters from the Israeli Air Force's 69th Squadron took off from Ramat David Air Base, southeast of Haifa, for a supposed emergency exercise and fly out into the Mediterranean. So now we're out over the Mediterranean in step two. Step two. 3 aircraft are ordered back. I would suppose that this would be to keep the subterfuge going, that the aircraft were flying on a totally different mission, just out over the Mediterranean and then back. I would suspect that would be the reason why these aircraft were turned back, as kind of as decoys to put the Syrians at ease. Well, then we move to the third step, which is entering the Syrian border, Syrian airspace. The remaining 7 change course and head for the Syrian border. There, they deactivate a Syrian radar station near Tal al-Abuad using later guided precision weapons and electronic jamming signals. And so now we move to the fourth stage of Operation Orchard. After a further 18 flight minutes, the aircraft reached the area near the town of Deir el-Zor on the Euphrates River and destroyed the Al-Kibar complex using Maverick missiles and 500-kilogram bombs. And here is the Al-Kibar nuclear complex. First of all, before, here is the suspected nuclear building, nuclear reactor building. And that's before the attack. And then after the attack, you can see the building has been completely destroyed and all the rubble has been bulldozed clean. And the area is clear of any nuclear complex. A very successful mission. October 9th, 2007, Syria refuses to attend the Middle East Peace Conference. Excuse me. This is when Israel declined to put the issue of the Golan Heights as a topic of discussion in the upcoming peace conference. Now, the conference is set for the last week of November. It's expected to produce a joint declaration to pave the way for negotiations on core issues, including Jerusalem and the refugees. So again, high expectations for this peace conference. The United States promises Syria that the issue of the Golan Heights will be brought up on the agenda during this regional peace conference. And so now we move in October to November 27th, 2007, and Annapolis, Maryland, the Annapolis Peace Conference. The Annapolis Conference was a Middle East peace conference held on the 27th of November, 2007 at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. The conference aimed to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and implement the roadmap for peace. The conference ended with the issuing of a joint statement from all parties. After the Annapolis conference, negotiations were continued. A joint understanding, read by U.S. President George Bush, stated that, in furtherance of the goal of two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace and security, the parties agreed to, quote, immediately launch good faith bilateral negotiations in order to conclude a peace treaty, resolve all outstanding issues, including all core issues without exception, as specified in previous agreements. High-sounding words, and this is now, I'm recording this in 2019, and none of this has been accomplished. A steering committee would meet from the 12th of December 2007, followed by biweekly negotiations between President Abbas and Prime Minister Olmert. The parties also committed to immediately implement their respective obligations under the Roadmap for Peace and continue the implementation of it, the roadmap, until they reach a peace treaty, which was to be concluded before the end of 2008. And here is the participants in the peace conference, Olmert on the left, Bush in the middle, and Abbas in the center. So this was to be concluded by the end of 2008, and it got nowhere. And so we move into 2008, and the terror against Israel simply continues. January 3rd, 2008, Palestinian militants fire a Katyusha rocket from Gaza. It had a longer range than usual, traveling from Gaza into northern Ashkelon. January 17, 2008, in an effort to pressure Hamas to stop rocket fire at Israel, Defense Minister Ehud Barak orders the closing of border crossings from Israel into Gaza. January 23, 2008, tens of thousands of Palestinians pour into Egypt from Gaza after Hamas militants blow holes in the border wall. January 4, 2008. It's been a busy January, isn't it? Approximately 700 Palestinian security forces go to Jordan to begin U.S. training for the new police force that would eventually be 50,000 strong. 50,000 men in a police force. That doesn't sound like a police force to me. It sounds like an army. February 3, 2008. Egypt refuses to cede control of the border to Hamas and reseals the damaged border crossing. February 4, 2008. Hamas military wing carries out a suicide bombing in the Israeli town of Dimona, killing one and injuring 23. February 12, 2008. Hezbollah terror chief Imad Mughniyeh is assassinated in Damascus. So this is the Hezbollah terror chief. The Hezbollah, of course, is located along the northern border with Lebanon, harassing Israel. March 20, 2008, Ami Oritz is injured and Messianic Jews are harassed. On March 28, 2008, 15-year-old Ami Oritz stayed home from school. And here is a picture of Ami to the left, his mother Leah in the middle, and his father David on the right. It was Purim, a Jewish festival in which holiday baskets are sent to friends and acquaintances to commemorate the Jews' thwarting of Haman's evil plot, as recorded in the Book of Esther. To Ami's delight, someone left a holiday package on the Oritz family doorstep. When the young Ami opened the package, it exploded in his face, filled his body with hundreds of pieces of shrapnel, and left him in critical condition. Here is the Ma'ariv newspaper article covering what happened to Ami. Ami's father, David, is a pastor of a Messianic community in the town of Ariel. So apparently, this was not an attempt to injure a 15-year-old boy, but rather an attempt to murder a minister of the gospel in Israel. Since then, two churches in Jerusalem were attacked by arsonists and burned. A pastor's car in Beit Shan was firebombed. A Messianic baker's business was denied the kashrut license only because the baker is a Messianic believer. Jobs have been lost, visas and citizenship denied because of faith in Yeshua. Flyers showing pictures of Messianic leaders and congregational members have been circulated in every major city and many smaller settlements in Israel. These flyers contain a message to the public to be aware of the missionaries who are trying to steal the souls of Jews and who masquerade as Jews but are not. Names and addresses have been published under the pictures, which is against the law. In Ariel, the flyers were posted on every bus stop from Tel Aviv to Ariel, a distance of 45 kilometers. Now, we don't know if the perpetrators of the bombing in the Oretz home were the ones who published the flyers. That's unknown. But at the very least, the flyers incited and helped them to identify the family and their addresses. Press and media coverage has continued extensively in the Ami Oretz case. On May of 2009, the FBI officially became involved in the case because David and Leah are dual American and Israeli citizens. Their help with the Shin Bet moved the investigation forward quickly until Jack Teitel was arrested on June 7, 2009. Apparently, Jack Teitel was the perpetrator of this bombing. He was tried and jailed. April 6, 2008, a Jewish group to slaughter the lamb in a Passover sacrifice rehearsal. The temple is not up, and so the actual Passover sacrifice cannot be performed. And so this is considered a rehearsal for that ceremony. A Bible-inherent Jewish group ritually slaughtered a young lamb in what is called a rehearsal for the renewal of the Passover sacrifice once the Jerusalem temple is rebuilt. Now here is the Passover sacrifice being reenacted by Jewish priests in training. These are members of the tribe of Levi, and they expect to serve in the temple when the third temple is rebuilt. So they're training for the sacrificial system. Now, the temple movement won approval to carry out the practice sacrifice from Israel's high court after animal rights groups asserted that the lamb would be put through inhumane suffering. And here is the little lamb on the right there on the bottom of the picture being prepared for the sacrifice. In its legal response, the temple movement explained that the slaughter would be carried out according to biblical standards, which is the same method used to slaughter lambs at kosher slaughterhouses around the country. So a minimum amount of suffering. The sacrifice and accompanying religious ceremonies were performed at a prominent yeshiva overlooking Jerusalem's Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is still occupied by several Muslim shrines. April 9, 2008. Terrorism continues into 2008. Palestinian gunmen killed two Israeli civilian employees at the Nachal Oz fuel depot, which pumps fuel into Gaza. April 16, 2008. Hamas ambushes and kills three Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip and fires more than 20 rockets into southern Israel. April 19, 2008, a suicide bombing and mortar ambush carried out by Hamas's military wing at the Karem Shalom crossing injures 13 Israeli soldiers. Israel retaliates with airstrikes, killing seven Hamas militants. April 25, 2008, five Palestinian groups claim responsibility for killing two Israeli security guards in Tul Karem in the West Bank. And so it never lets up. July 8, 2008, two Jewish priests fitted for service in the future Jerusalem temple. Confident that Israel's temple to the Almighty will be rebuilt atop Jerusalem's Temple Mount in the very near future, the Temple Institute this month began fitting Jews from the priestly caste of Levi for their holy garments. The Bible describes a very specific set of garments to be worn by members of the priestly tribe when they're serving in the temple. And here's a photograph of this Levite being measured for his Levitical garments. The month's fitting was the first time since the destruction of the Second Temple over 2,000 years ago that potential Jewish priests were measured for such garments. Following the fitting, each potential future priest was presented with a set of garments matching the biblical description. And when the temple is rebuilt, a fresh set of garments will need to be made for each priest, as they can be only used in the temple. So if they wear this first set of garments, they will be appropriate for use in the temple, and they'll get a fresh set. The Temple Institute has for decades been involved in preparing the various garments and instruments and other items needed to dedicate what will be known as the Third Temple. And for example, here's the high priest's garments. This is Rashi's opinion of how they should look. And then there's the high priest's garment according to Maimonides' opinion. So these garments apparently have been made already. Most Jews and Christians believe the Third Temple will be built atop the Temple Mount, today occupied by an Islamic mosque and an Islamic shrine. The Temple Mount the Third Temple will be built with the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of his direct reign on earth. And so here is the Temple Mount today. This is the way it looks today. This is the Dome of the Rock, the Islamic shrine, sitting probably exactly where the temple should sit. More than likely, that's the location of the temple. To the south is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the actual mosque on the Temple Mount proper. And here is a picture of the Third Temple superimposed over modern Jerusalem. Mine looks like something like that. Here's another version of that same idea, the Third Temple surrounded by modern Jerusalem. And some think that the Third Temple will be built to the north of the Dome of the Rock. They feel that there's room to do it there and that that's where it would be constructed, leaving the Dome of the Rock in place, keeping the Muslims happy. So that's another opinion regarding the Third Temple. All right, July 27, 2008, new Israeli regulations would crimple Christian ministries. Israel's Ministry of the Interior has decided to reinstate an old regulation that is threatening to cripple, if not shut down, several Christian ministries by limiting the time volunteers can spend serving in Israel, some 27 months. The ruling was as sudden as it was drastic. The effects began to be felt earlier this month, when three volunteers from Christian Friends for Israel, assuming their visas would be renewed by the Interior Ministry under the previous five-year agreement, were instead told they had 2 weeks to pack up and leave the country. September 23, 2008, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaks at the UN. He's the Iranian president. In an address to the United Nations General Assembly on the 23rd of September 2008, Ahmadinejad stated that Zionists are criminals and murderers. They're acquisitive, deceitful, and dominate global finance despite their minuscule number. This man is an anti-Semite to the core and is just spouting anti-Semite lies that have been floating around for many, many years. May I ask, if we in the Jewish community are so dominant in everything, how come we can't even set up our own state in peace in the Middle East? Nobody asks that question. The Jews are so dominant, how come they don't rule the world? How come? Well, that's because they're a shadow state in the background, ruling everything through influence. That's the anti-Semitic tropes professed by Iran and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and many other organizations and people around the world. He further stated that it is a deeply disastrous to witness that some presidential nominees have to visit these people, the Zionists, take part in their gatherings and swear their allegiance and commitment to their interests in order to win financial and media support. See, the Jews control all the finance and all the media. We're sure doing a rotten job if that's true, I would think. These nations are spending their dignity and resources on the crimes and threats of the Zionist network against their will. Ahmadinejad stated that the Zionist regime was on a path to collapse and that the underhanded actions of the Zionists was among the causes for the recent unrest in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. In a subsequent interview with the Los Angeles Times, Ahmadinejad stated that the Zionist regime resembles an airplane that has lost its engine and is kind of going down. And no one can help it, he said. This will benefit everyone. Well, the Zionist regime has not gone down yet. It will go down during the tribulation period, and then it will be revived for the Messianic kingdom. So much for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Let's move to November 4th, 2008. Democrat Barack Obama decisively wins the United States presidential election. 78% of the Jewish community votes for him. And he turns out to be the most anti-Israel president of the United States in recent years. He had a terrible relationship with Israel. December 27, 2008. Israeli Defense Forces launch Operation Cast Lead to halt Hamas rocket fire on Israel from the Gaza Strip. Israel's Operation Cast Lead comes after 3 years of suffering thousands of daily Palestinian rocket attacks on Israel's southern cities. Of course, this is by Hamas from the Gaza Strip. Since the start of the operation, Hamas has increased their number of attacks and has fired hundreds of rockets into Israel. Hamas is firing an average of 80 rockets a day into Israel in December. Now, here, of course, is the State of Israel. This is the Gaza Strip. And this is the Gaza Strip in more detail. The built-up areas are light pink. The refugee camps are in the dark red. So the rocket fire is coming from this area, from the Gaza Strip. Rockets were fired into Ashdod. Now, here's the Gaza Strip here. Here's the town of Ashdod. And Ashkelon, south of Ashdod, for the first time. And Grad rockets have been hitting Beersheba. And here's Beersheba in this location. So here's another map showing the ranges of the rockets. Here is Ashdod and Ashkelon and Beersheba. It's clear that Hamas widened their rocket range in response to the incursion into Gaza. Due to Hamas's endless and widespread barrage of rockets on Israeli towns, the IDF Home Front Command has expanded their security precautions to all towns within a 19-mile radius of Gaza. Schools in Ashdod, Ashkelon, Beersheba, and other southern cities are closed as Hamas continues purposely firing rockets into civilian centers of all major cities. Since the Israeli airstrike began, 4 Israelis have been killed and over 176 wounded, while hundreds are being treated for shock. Israel's southern citizens have been forced to move into bomb shelters as their community schools, buildings, and roads are destroyed in front of their eyes. In 2 weeks, Hamas has fired 500 rockets into Israel's southern cities. Many of these have been the more deadly Grad Katyusha rockets. On January 6th, a 3-month-old girl was wounded when a Grad rocket was fired into Gedera. And here is Gedera, another town hit by these rockets. On January 8th, 4 people were wounded as mortar shells were fired into the Eshkol region. The Eshkol region is down here very close to the Gaza Strip. Now, the population that is affected by these rocket attacks is over 800,000 people. Almost 1 million people are coming under these rocket attacks. Now, here is a map of the warning time you have when the time a rocket is fired from the Gaza Strip until it lands in various areas. The green area, you have 15 seconds warning when you know the rocket is coming. In the blue area, you have 30 seconds warning that the rocket is on its way. In the purple area, you have 45 seconds warning. And in the brown area, you have 1 minute's warning. So not a lot of time. Not a lot of time. On Thursday morning, January 8th, Palestinian terrorists fired multiple rockets into Nahariya, an Israeli city on the northern border of Lebanon. So now we move from the Gaza Strip north up into the Galilee. Here is the northern Israel. This is Nahariya on the coast. One of the rockets hit a retirement home and two were wounded. Three rockets were fired again from Lebanon on January 14th into Kiryat Shmona. And here is Kiryat Shmona in the panhandle of the northernmost northern area of Israel. Israel is holding the Lebanese government responsible because it's Lebanon's job to prevent the attempted rocket attacks on Israel, and they don't do their job. Syria to the east is involving itself in the conflict. On Sunday, January 11th, Syrian citizens fired shots at IDF troops and civilian workers who were repairing a fence along the border wall. Excuse me, along the border. There's no wall there, just a fence. Israel fired a complaint with the UN and is investigating the incident. On January 11th and 12th, the volume of Hamas rockets decreased, but their firing range has widened. On January 12th, 30 rockets were fired into the south, as opposed to the usual average of 80 rockets per day. And for the first time, a Hamas-fired Qassam rocket was able to reach the Kiryat Gat area. So now we move again from Galilee back down to Gaza. And this next rocket fell on Kiryat Gat, another city under siege by rocket fire. The Gaza War, also known as Operation Cast Lead, was a three-week armed conflict in the Gaza Strip between Israel and Palestinian militants that began on the 27th of December 2008 and ended on the 18th of January 2009 with a unilateral ceasefire. Israel's stated goal was to stop rocket fire into Israel and weapons smuggling into the Gaza Strip. After the beginning of the conflict, Palestinian groups continued firing rockets in response to what they characterized as massacres. Israeli forces had attacked police stations, military targets, including weapons caches and suspected rocket firing teams, as well as political and administrative institutions in the opening assault. They struck in the densely populated cities of Gaza, which is in the north of the Gaza Strip, Khan Yunis in the south, and Rafah in the far south on the Egyptian border. An Israeli ground invasion began on January 3rd. Infantry commanders were given an unprecedented level of access to coordinate air, naval, artillery, intelligence, and combat engineering units during the second phase. Various new technologies and hardware were also introduced. On January 5th, the IDF began operating in the densely populated urban centers of Gaza. During the last week of the offensive, Israel mostly hit targets that had been damaged before and struck Palestinian rocket launching units. Hamas intensified its rocket and mortar attacks against civilian targets in southern Israel before, reaching the major cities of Beersheba and Ashdod for the first time during the conflict. Israeli politicians ultimately decided against striking deeper into Gaza amid concerns of higher casualties for both sides and rising international criticism. Okay, that brings us to the year 2009. We'll pick it up in January 17th, 2009. Israel declares a ceasefire to end Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. Hamas rejects Israel's call for a ceasefire. They want to keep going for a little while longer. But its leadership announces its own ceasefire 12 hours later. Probably just a little act of defiance there. January 18, 2009, the Israeli government opens an emergency clinic in the Eretz Crossing in an effort to provide humanitarian assistance and medical care to the Palestinian civilian population of Gaza. So Israel is not interested in hurting the civilians, just stopping the military attacks against the country. January 22, 2009, George Mitchell is the named special envoy to the Middle East by President Obama. January 27, 2009, Arab-Palestinian militants donate a bomb at the Kisufim crossing Here is the Gaza Strip, and this is the Kisufim crossing, killing one Israeli soldier and wounding three. March 5th, 2009, a Palestinian Arab resident of East Jerusalem attacks an Israeli police car and a bus on the Menachem Begin Expressway in Jerusalem using a bulldozer, injuring two police officers before being shot to death. And here is that terrorist attack in Jerusalem. You can see the bus that was turned over by that huge bulldozer. Here is the bulldozer itself, and then the driver of that bulldozer was eventually shot. March 31st, 2009, Benjamin Netanyahu is sworn in as Israeli Prime Minister and head of the new coalition government. And here is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. April 3, 2009, the United Nations establishes a fact-finding mission on the Gaza War, headed by Richard Goldstone. He's the leader of the UN fact-finding mission on the Gaza War. He's an international jurist from South Africa. June 4, 2009, President Obama calls for a new beginning between the United States and Muslims in an historic speech in Cairo. Relations between the Obama administration and Israel begin to sour. June 14, 2009. Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech at the Begin Sadat Center. For the first time, Netanyahu endorses the principle of a Palestinian state alongside of Israel. September 15, 2009, the Goldstone report is issued. Goldstone releases his report, accusing both Israel and Hamas of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity during the Gaza War. On November 3, 2009, the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly passes a resolution denouncing the Goldstone report as irredeemably biased and unworthy of future consideration or legitimacy. November 25, 2009, Prime Minister Netanyahu announces that Israel will impose a 10-month freeze on construction in the West Bank settlements in a bid to restart stalled peace talks with the Palestinians. So the Annapolis conference had gone nowhere, and again, Israel is trying to set a positive atmosphere for some sort of progress. December 24, 2009, Rabbi Meir Avshalom of Shavei Shomrom is killed in a drive-by shooting near his home, and so the terror continues. The terror continues. So that moves us now to 2010. We pick it up on March 15th. Excuse me, let me back up a few minutes here, a few months here. We'll start on February 10th, 2010 with the Tupuach Junction stabbing. A Palestinian Authority police officer stabs an Israeli soldier to death. Then on February 24, 2010, the murder of Netta Sorek, an Israeli woman, is stabbed to death by Palestinian terrorists. And now we come up to March 15, 2010, and the rebuilt Hurva Synagogue is dedicated. The Hurva Synagogue, the Ruin Synagogue, also known as Hurvat Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, the Ruin of Rabbi Judah the Pious, is an historic synagogue located in the Jewish quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem. The synagogue was founded in the early 18th century by followers of Judah Chassid, but was destroyed by Muslims a few years later in 1721. The plot lay in ruins for over 140 years and became known as the Ruin, the Churva. In 1864, the Perushim, an ascetic sect, rebuilt the synagogue, and although officially named the Beit Yaakov Synagogue, it retained its name as the Hurva. And here is the Hurva Synagogue in 1898, and then is the northern facade in around 1930. And this is the eastern facade around 1930. It became Jerusalem's main Ashkenazi synagogue until it too was deliberately destroyed after withdrawal of Israeli forces by the Arab League during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. After Israel captured East Jerusalem from Jordan in 1967, a number of plans were submitted for the design of a new building. After deliberation and indecision, a commemorative arch was erected instead at the site in 1977, itself becoming a prominent landmark in the Jewish community, in the Jewish quarter. And here is that commemorative arch. And I personally have never been in or seen the Herva Synagogue, but I have walked in that area when the commemorative arch was in place during a number of my visits to Israel. The plan to rebuild the synagogue in its 19th century style received approval by the Israeli government in 2000, and the newly rebuilt synagogue was dedicated on March 15, 2010. And here's the new Herva Synagogue, a gorgeous building, very beautiful building, and on the outside as well as on the inside. Again, here's the Herva Synagogue on the inside. The company involved with its reconstruction believes that restoring the synagogue to its former glory will once again allow it to serve as a center of world Jewry. May 31, 2010, the Gaza Flotilla Raid. On the morning of May 31, 2010, IDF naval forces intercepted six ships attempting to break the naval blockade of the Gaza Strip. And here's a map of the incident. The ships left from Cyprus to be intercepted by the IDF Navy out in the Mediterranean Sea. After numerous warnings issued by Israel prior to the action, the Navy requested for the ships to redirect toward Ashdod, where they could unload their material, which would be transferred via land crossing to Gaza after undergoing proper security inspections. This was supposedly humanitarian material. And Israel is saying, I'm sorry, we won't let you drop it off directly into Gaza. We want you drop it off in Ashdod. We'll just examine it to make sure it is humanitarian material, and then we'll send it on into Gaza. And they did not want to go through that procedure. This is the MV Mavi Marmara. This was the major ship, the biggest ship involved in the flotilla. When the vessels refused to alter their course, teams of elite naval commandos were tasked in overtaking the ships. And so the ships continued on their predetermined course toward the Gaza Strip. During the boarding of the lead ship, the Mavi Marmara, demonstrators on board attacked the IDF personnel with live fire, light weaponry, knives, and clubs. And so the IDF Navy, of course, shadowed the ships. And here is activists preparing to attack. They knew the IDF was out there. They were preparing to attack any soldiers that would board their ship. And here are soldiers being hit with metal rods by the Mavi Marmara terrorists that were on board. Additionally, two weapons were grabbed from an IDF soldier and used against him. And as a result of the violence, seven soldiers were wounded, nine Turkish activists killed. And the flotilla was therefore apprehended by the IDF Navy, and the flotilla was turned to Ashdod. Taken to Ashdod for unloading the humanitarian material. The humanitarian aid was eventually unloaded at the Gaza border crossing, but was refused by Hamas, and so it was sent to the Kerem Shalom crossing. And here is the flotilla cargo en route to the Kerem Shalom crossing. So the humanitarian aid did get into Gaza. Israel does not want to prevent humanitarian aid from getting in. They just want to prevent military equipment from getting into Gaza. And so that was carried out by trucks. The humanitarian aid was brought into the Gaza Strip. On August 31, 2010, Hamas terrorists shoot dead four Israeli civilians near Kiryat Arba, including a pregnant woman. December 18, 2010 is the murder of Christine Lucan. And this is Christine Lucan. She's an American woman stabbed to death by Palestinian terrorists. Another woman was severely injured. The attack site was Beit Shemesh to the west of Jerusalem. This attack coming from inside Jerusalem, inside Israel itself. Now we move into 2011, and we come to the Itamar massacre. Two Palestinians infiltrate the town of Itamar and murder five members of the Fogel family in their beds. Among the victims are three young children, including an infant. And here's the mother, mom and dad, Fogel, and their three children, all murdered in their beds. Let me back up a little on that. March 23rd, 2011. Jerusalem bus stop bombing. Hamas bombs a bus station in Jerusalem, kills one civilian, and 39 are injured. April 7th, 2011, Hamas school bus attack. Hamas militants bomb an Israeli school bus and kill a teenager. August 18th, 2011, Egyptian and Palestinian militants attack southern Israel and kill eight Israelis, including six civilians. 40 are injured. Five Egyptian soldiers are also killed. September 2011, Palestinian Authority moves a resolution in the UN for recognition of Palestinian statehood, calling it the Palestinian Spring. And this resolution got nowhere, went nowhere. October 18, 2011, the Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange. The Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange followed an agreement between Israel and Hamas to release Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in exchange for 1,027 prisoners. That's correct, 1,027 prisoners, mainly Palestinians and Arab Israelis, although among the prisoners there was also a Ukrainian prisoner, a Jordanian prisoner, and a Syrian prisoner. And here is the cartoon of the incident. Here is the Palestinian prisoners being released. And this one fellow in the center is kind of down in the mouth. Why? Because he said, I did the math. I'm worth 70 grams of an Israeli soldier. In other words, I'm not worth very much to Hamas. And he's right. 280 of these men, of these prisoners, were sentenced to life in prison for planning and perpetrating various terror attacks against Israeli targets. And yet they are let out of jail. And this is the Palestinian pyramid scheme by Drybones. In the yellow box we read, you want to kidnap dozens of more Israeli hostages? Yes, says the other Hamas member. Next yellow box. And we'll have the manpower to do it once they release the hundreds of convicts in return for the one hostage we're now housing. We're now holding. Wow. Pretty impressive, huh? No wonder they call you slick. Thanks. That's Drybone's view of the release. Hamas military leader Ahmed Yavari was quoted in the Saudi Arabian newspaper Al Hayat as confirming that the prisoners released as part of the deal were collectively responsible for the killing of 569 Israeli civilians. The agreement came 5 years and 4 months after Palestinian militants captured Shalit in southern Israel along the Gaza border. Now, the deal, brokered by German and Egyptian mediators and coordinated by Gerhard Conrad, was signed in Egypt on the 11th of October 2011. Its first phase was executed on the 18th of October 2011, with Israel releasing 477 Palestinian prisoners and Hamas transferring Shalit to Cairo. In the second phase, which took place during December 2011, another 550 prisoners were released. The agreement is the largest prisoner exchange agreement Israel has ever made, given that as part of the agreement, Israel agreed to release 1,027 prisoners for one captured Israeli soldier. This is the highest price Israel has ever paid for a single soldier. So Gilad Shalit was the first captured Israeli soldier to be released alive in 26 years. And here's Gilad Shalit getting off the airplane back in Israel and meeting Prime Minister Netanyahu. November 2011, Palestine wins membership of UNESCO while the UN vote on statehood is put off, and no support from France or the UK while the US threatened to veto it. All right, we're now at 2012, and I see that I am just about out of time. just about out of time. So we'll pick it up next session on January 1st, 2012, with the terrorism continuing. Anything new? No, nothing new. Terrorism just keeps going on and on. All right. Thanks so much for being our students. Thanks so much for joining us in this session. We'll see you next session as we begin in 2012. Again, Lehi Tzara'ot, Lehi Tzara'ot.